The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This corner, weighing in with his take on current events, the smarty of the party, the mighty mite from the right, the heavyweight of debate, the man who's in cahoots with the grassroots. And in this corner, weighing in with his take on current events, the smarty of the party, the mighty mite from the right, the heavyweight of debate, the man who's in cahoots with the grassroots, the broadcaster master, Jimmy Sangenberger.
Saturday night is always all right for the Jimmy Sangenberger Show right here on News Talk 710 at KNUS. And indeed, such a pleasure and a privilege it is to be back with you once again for, this is show number 3 for Independence Day weekend. Happy Independence Day, one and all. Indeed, yesterday I filled in for Stephen Tubbs here on 710 KNUS. And then earlier this morning, I had the opportunity to sit in for none other than George Brockler on the George Show. And now we're here with my own program, with the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. Great to be with you once again. And indeed, happy Independence Day, one and all. So great to be with you celebrating this holiday. And I said it earlier today, I said it yesterday, I've said it every time I host on Independence Day weekend, that I call it Independence Day. Two big reasons. Number one, because of the significance of independence, Declaration of Independence. That's what we're celebrating on this day. How we broke off from the British Empire and forged a new nation conceived in liberty. And we have to acknowledge that. I mean, and with independence comes freedom. Independence Day does a much better job at describing what we're celebrating than the 4th of July does. Number two, you might not know this, but they have a 4th of July in England. They actually have a 4th of July in England. They just don't celebrate it. Independence Day helps set apart this day on the calendar that is the 4th of July. And so that's why I emphasize Independence Day as opposed to the 4th of July. And later on tonight, in the last half hour of the program, I'm going to do something that I did on George's show and on Stephen's show, which is read the entirety of the Declaration of Independence here on this very program and then play for us to listen to and enjoy one of the great patriotic songs of all time, America the Beautiful, performed, I think, at its very best by the great late Ray Charles. In full, we'll hear that tune. Because we need to celebrate this country, embrace it. We're still proud to be Americans here on 710 KNUS. I know you are. I sure am. And we have so much to be proud of. I mean, think about this country and what we've overcome, what we've accomplished, how much we have advanced human freedom. It's remarkable when you think about it. Truly remarkable, the achievements We'll talk about that later on in the show. Also tonight, I'm going to share a few interviews from my web show this week in partnership with the Washington Examiner called Jimmy at the Crossroads. Get details, check out videos of interviews and full episodes and more on my website, jimmyatthecrossroads.com. That's one place to go, jimmyatthecrossroads.com. We can also, well, there's a lot of stuff that you can check out there. Now, I should note that if you want to participate on this show and interact and engage with me, there are a few ways to do that these days. One, you can tweet at me 24/7, 365, at Sang Center. That's Sang with an E, not an A, Center, on Twitter. You can also email me on the 710KNUS website. Go to the Jimmy Sangenberger Show page, where you can access podcasts going back years for this very program, and also shoot me an email. And at my personal website, jimmysangenberger.com, you can go to the contact page and email me there. Remember, there's no A, there's no I, there's no you in Sangenberger. It's all E's all the time. Once you know that, Sangenberger is easy. And by the way, on that website I mentioned before, the JimmyAtTheCrossroads.com website, there is a t-shirt that you can get that is Sangenberger, all E's all the time. Check it out. JimmyAtTheCrossroads.com. So tonight we're going to share an interview I did this past week with Michael Barone. Of course, the man, the myth, the legend, the noted senior political analyst at the Washington Examiner. I'll also share my conversation with Dr. Richard Vedder on the skyrocketing cost of college education from Friday's Free to Choose Friday edition of that web show. And also here on 710KNUS, I'll be joined by Zach Boren with the Urban Institute. With Dr. Vedder, we'll share a conversation about the skyrocketing cost of college education. With Zach Boren, going to talk with him about what's happening in terms of apprenticeships, which provide a tremendous opportunity to get a good quality education without the college experience. Starting to grow more and more of these apprenticeship programs. We will talk with Zach Boren about that. We'll read the Declaration of Independence, talk about its significance right here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. And I think we might share an interview I did this week with Rashini Rajkumar about what's happening on the ground in Minneapolis, this original epicenter of the effort to defund the police. You do not want to miss all of that. But first, I really feel like, before we get into my interview with Michael Barone from this week, I really feel like sharing a fun little bonus bumper from the great Robert Cray, who's just sitting there waiting for the tide to turn.
I'm all alone. My money's short, so I'm sticking close to home and waiting. Waiting for the tide to turn. Time will bring on some changes. It's one sure thing that I've learned. Got no woman now. When a woman's what I need. When my ship comes in, I'm gonna have me two or three. I'm waiting. Waiting for the tide to turn. Patience, patience, patience. One sure thing that I've learned. Every time I fall, I bounce a little higher. I get back five for every dollar that I lose. Every time I'm down, real good times follow. But don't you feel bad for me when you hear this blues? Mm-hmm.
gotta love a nice little bonus bumper from the great Robert Cray as we do it right here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS. Well, we've got these really long segments now. Why not sometimes break away and get a little bit more of the best bumper music known to man right here on 710 KNUS every Saturday night, 5 to 8 p.m. Okay, let's go right to my interview from earlier this week with Michael Barone. Today, our very special guest is none other than the man I like to call our one-man political almanac, and also is, of course, the senior political analyst at The Washington Examiner. Michael Barone joins us once again here on Jimmy at the Crossroads. Michael, good to have you, sir. How the heck are you?
Well, doing as well as can be expected, given the news that we've been having to deal with and the confines of an unexpected pandemic.
That is true. It is always a struggle for everybody, but we have to keep on trucking through it. So I just want to ask you a broad political question for a moment. By the way, the reason why I call you One Man Political Almanac is you helped write what book, Michael Barone?
The Almanac American Politics, first edition of which came out in November 1971, some years ago, and worked on that for about 40-some years.
Remarkable.
You know, 900,000 words in addition, so whatever.
Precisely. So, yeah. with that said, I want to remind folks of that. So, in terms of this era, this point that we're in American political history, it's very unique in a lot of different ways, but still has resonance with historical events. People have been talking about the 1960s and the unrest that we saw then. We've seen discussions about the 1918 pandemic and what have you. How would you encapsulate this political moment that we are in 2020, Michael Barone, in a historical context?
Well, it's, you know, you brought up the parallel with the 1960s, and I remember that era quite well. In fact, I was working as an intern in the mayor's office directly with the mayor of Detroit in the summer of 1967 when we had a riot that killed 43 people, violence that destroyed commercial frontage housing and things in Detroit to an extent which has never been fully repaired, and, you know, sent that city on a downward spiral that it only just started to recover from in the last several years. So, you know, it seems like yes, the supposedly saying of Yogi Berra was deja vu all over again. You know, we're hearing complaints that, the death of this suspect in Minneapolis shows that Black Americans are treated as badly by the police as ever, simply isn't true. It has evoked, however, a kind of religious relationship. The linguist John McWhorter has written well about this, Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal, a kind of anti-racism religion in which you know, has elements of original sin, of begging forgiveness, of ritual atonements, and so forth, that supplies for many people the kind of satisfactions and explanation of the cosmos that they have a yearning for. I see people trying to satisfy their yearnings in certain ways that go beyond what we've seen in the past. We had the riots of the 1960s. We didn't have the element of Democratic members of Congress putting on kente cloth, of people in Bethesda kneeling and begging forgiveness, white racism. We hadn't seen those kind of elements in the past. And in the relationship to the pandemic, we lived through about 2 to 3 months of lockdown to varying extents, depending on what part of the country you're in, whether you're in an urban or rural setting. It's interesting to compare that. We had something called the Hong Kong flu in 1957-58. We had Asian flu in 1968-69 during the same period. Then we were having riots in the streets of many American cities at that time. But we didn't try the lockdown. We didn't seem to feel that we had the capacity as a society to simply shut down very large parts of the economy, confine people to their basic, to their households and to grocery shopping and a couple of other supposedly necessary activities. It's a society that feels that it can do things which past societies didn't really feel capable of. And I fear that it's setting itself up for failure, attempts to achieve things that even this sophisticated and advanced society can't really achieve.
Yeah, going back to your point here, Michael Barone, our guest, senior political analyst at the Washington Examiner, about the new religion of woke anti-racism, I want to read a passage from one of your recent columns on that very topic. You point out that the linguist John McWhorter elaborated on this theme in The Atlantic. Anti-racism, he wrote, is a profoundly religious movement in everything but terminology. McWhorter likened the notion of white privilege to original sin, argued that the hope that Americans will, quote, come to terms with race is as vague as hopes for Judgment Day, and observed that the faithful on the lookout for, quote, that which may be blasphemous resort to social media shaming tantamount to the excommunication of the heretic. And you go on this, but what's interesting is that this is language that McWhorter and others like Andrew Sullivan were writing about a couple years ago. This was 2018. This was not 2020, yet it really captures this sort of fervor that we're seeing across the nation right now. And you also go about this in your piece. You talk about science, a sort of religion of science as well. So you've got this woke anti-racism sentiment, but you've also got this scientific ideology that is very much religious in nature in a lot of respects. Talk to us about those things.
Well, you have people who... One of the things that we've seen in public opinion polling is declining percentages of people who say that they're religious in terms of standard religious denominations, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, whatever. We see more people, you do see more people moving from religious sects that don't ask very much of their believers to those that do ask a lot in terms of belief and in behavior. But you also have a falling away, a willingness to say you're an atheist, you're an agnostic, you're secular, and so forth. Politically, these people who take this view are highly correlated with the liberal side of the Democratic Party, though not every one of them is. It's one is reminded of the remark attributed apparently erroneously to the British writer of a century ago, G.K. Chesterton, a man who says a man who believes in nothing will believe in anything. And one of the things you see in public opinion polling is that those who don't have traditional religious beliefs are much more likely than other Americans to believe in astrology, to believe that there are stones that have characteristics, what are the rocks of Sedona, Arizona, and things that have emanations and so forth. These same people say they believe in science with a capital S, but like many people on all points of the political spectrum, they tend to emphasize the parts of science that substantiate their normative beliefs rather than and to avoid mention of those which tend to undercut them.
Yeah, and in terms of science, one of the things that I think they forget or ignore conveniently is the idea that putting science to work. So, for example, in terms of the coronavirus crisis, we have seen politicians say, well, the science tells us this. Well, okay, science can inform you as to the gravity of a situation, what's causing a certain pandemic to spread, and what have you. But science cannot reason through that to a public policy solution. Public policy is a little different from just looking at science. And the science in this case is only as good as those who are using the science in order to effectuate public policy. And this notion of science as sort of a capital S religious sort of idea, as you're talking about, I think gets to the heart of how one could say, well, the science tells us this, therefore we must do that. But that is not just a logical A to B type of scenario, is it?
And this is a novel coronavirus, and as the experts, the ones that I've listened to, tell us, we don't know everything about it. One of the lucky things we have in America, we have people like Dr. Fauci, Dr. Bricks, who appear to be, of all the people in the world, as expert as we could possibly hope for, people in official positions. They've been advising the president. They've been speaking to the public. Their voice and advice has been heard. But they haven't always been right, as they admit. Dr. Fauci in January was saying, it looks like this is not a pandemic. Turned out to be wrong. We had people assuming initially that the ventilators in hospitals would help people with respiratory difficulties breathe. Turns out they tended to kill most of the people that they used. Didn't work with this virus, as it were, as with sufferers from the influenza virus and other things. We have learned that the fears that doorknobs would carry the virus for long periods of time simply turn out not to be true, and that the virus is largely spread indoors. We've had people, public officials who say we're following the science. Don't go outdoors. Don't go to the beach. Don't go. We learn by doing. It was pretty obvious from the beginning that this virus had a particularly negative effect on elderly people, and particularly those with so-called morbid technologies, high diabetes, gross obesity, things like that, comorbidities, other illnesses. And yet we had Governor Cuomo of York, much praised by many people, on March 25th, Governor Murphy of New Jersey at just about the same time, Governor Newsom of California, Governor Whitmer of Michigan, ordering patients with identified as being infected with coronavirus to be admitted to nursing homes. In New York, they could not be barred. It was written as a sort of discrimination case. The nursing home can't even test people to see if they have that when they're being admitted there. Well, what was that? That was done out of concern, apparently, for keeping hospital beds, intensive care unit beds open. But turns out, obviously, in retrospect, that was a mistake. Contributed majorly to deaths. Perhaps as many as 40% to 50% of deaths in the U.S. have been attributed to nursing homes. Governor DeSantis of Florida kept people that were identified as being infected with the virus out of nursing homes and provided other facilities for them. That turned out to be much better. And I would say Governor Newsom in California revoked his order after 10 days, apparently decided that it was not a good idea to put infected people in nursing homes. Governor Cuomo did not do so until May 10th, and he still won't admit he made a mistake.
All right, we'll be right back here on the Jimmy Sengenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS, the Independence Day 2020 edition of the program. We'll share the rest of my interview with Michael Barone from the Washington Examiner and so much more. We're just getting started, revved up and ready to go. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Coming back on the Jimmy Sengenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS. Thanks for joining us, being a part of the program on this Independence Day, July 4th, 2020. Such a pleasure and a privilege to be with you as always, as we are now halfway through the first of 3 hours. But really, for me, this is what we're in the midst of the 8th hour of KNUS radio for yours truly, having filled in for Stephen Tubbs last night, which was a lot of fun. And then having the opportunity to sit in for George Brockler, who's always first on our Saturday lineup, followed, of course, by Randy Corcoran from 9 to noon. It was just a great time the last couple of shows. And alas, here is the capstone program. And I've been wanting to share, and this is what we started doing in the first segment, previous segment, is share with you my interview with Michael Barone for my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner called Jimmy at the Crossroads, which you can find at youtube.com/Jimmy at the Crossroads. He's always so insightful, of course, senior political analyst at the Examiner. So I want to share with you, without further ado, the rest of my interview with Michael Barone. Speaking of coronavirus, one of the things that we're seeing right now across the country is a spike in Florida, in Arizona, in Texas, in California. Several states, particularly with larger populations for the most part, are seeing these upticks, but also particularly hot places where people feel more desire during the summertime to go indoors, which, as you pointed out, is the primary place where this kind of virus can spread. Well, one of the implications of this is, and there's a headline here from the Wall Street Journal, coronavirus concerns follow RNC to Jacksonville. And it talks about how the Republican National Convention, which is supposed to be set up now in Jacksonville, are doing a couple of different events in different places, but they're rethinking, or going to have to rethink, how they go about these in-person events, most likely, especially because of the spread of this virus in Jacksonville, Florida. We already know, or in Florida, rather. And we already know that the Democrats are planning to hold their convention predominantly electronically, so remotely from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I want to put this into historical perspective because we haven't seen anything like this before. And I'd love for you to speak a little bit about what's going on here as you view it, especially from a historical perspective, vis-a-vis these national conventions for the two major parties in 2020.
Well, this is one issue where it seems to me that the Democrats have are headed towards the right, and the Republicans are maybe making some major mistakes here in response to the coronavirus and with the national conventions. I have attended in one way, shape, or form 24 Democratic and Republican national conventions dating back to the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. They had terrific weather. They also had a certain amount of bloodshed and a certain amount of rioting and things out of control at that convention, and tumult in the convention hall. The conventions changed their character. Then changing it just about the time that I started in 1968. Historically, the conventions, which date 1832 for the Democrats, 1856 for the Republicans, with the Whigs having several conventions from before 1856. They were a communications media. The only place where politicians from the different state political parties could get together, negotiate, and choose a candidate for president. That was because of the constitutional framework, the one sort of nomination that really defined the party nationally. And that, you know, they became, nobody knew how many delegates anybody had. Nobody knew until call was called. As late as 1960, nominated by the Democrats. I remember watching that on television, and they're in the alphabetical roll call of the states, and he doesn't get over the top until Wyoming, the 50th state, the last one on the roll call. The announcers didn't know whether or not he's going to make it at that point. And, you know, the conventions were changed. They lost their monopoly of political communication by technological developments that take place in the 1950s. Long-distance telephone, direct-distance dialing. Before about 1957 in most United States, you couldn't place a long-distance call from your local telephone. You had to call a long-distance operator and then wait for her. It was almost always a her to respond. Men of business, the few women of business, didn't talk to each other by long-distance phone. It was real expensive. It was clumsy and difficult to do. They didn't do that. We also got jet aircraft in the 1950s, passenger aircraft across the country. So the convention used to be the only place that politicians met and really communicated in a way that was frank and open between each other and really negotiated. Jet aircraft, long-distance phone changed that. And the network coverage changes that. 1968 was the first delegate count by a television network. CBS News, Martin Plissner, counted the delegates and how many delegates supported each candidate. Nobody knew this before 1968. People were wildly wrong about the number of delegates that were committed to a particular candidate. That also changed. So the conventions became, by the 70s and 80s, television programs in which the nominee tried to show off to best advantage at a time when most television markets were dominated by ABC, NBC, CBS, and they all broadcast the conventions on the prime time, 8 to 11 Eastern in the evening, on all three networks, and viewers didn't have much choice. They were locked into watching the conventions. And you saw great surges of support often from people for a candidate of a party who was presented at the convention, the bounce, as it was called. 21st, we see some changes in that. We got a proliferation of television stations and choices. We don't get as many people watching the conventions, even the nominee's speech, as we used to. And the convention audiences tend to be tilted towards supporters of a particular party. Donald Trump was watched mainly by Republicans and Republicans of the ilk that like Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton was watched mainly by Democrats and people that tended to like Hillary Clinton. That was, the case in 2016. You don't see the bounces off the conventions because you're not exposed. Most voters don't use much in the bounces anymore. They can hurt a candidate, can't particularly help them. So I think the Democrats, are making a decision of saying, well, we'll present our little television show and our side voters will watch it and we'll try to make a little news. We've got a mostly sympathetic news medium and see how that works out. Donald Trump is determined to speak, it seems, before a big in-person audience. But in an era when we're supposed to do social distancing, and I think this is one thing that the science has got right, and we're not supposed to listen to people cheering and singing songs and hurling spittle in the direction of people that are standing right next to them. And I can tell you that having been on the convention floors many times, you can't move. It's very hard to move on a convention floor.
Yeah, in fact, let me add, if I could contribute, in 2016, I was an alternate delegate to the Republican National Convention. I did have a couple of opportunities where, an actual delegate would say, hey, do you want a chance to go down to the floor? And so we switched badges temporarily. And so I went down on the floor. And you're absolutely right. I mean, it is jam-packed. And also in the upper levels for alternate delegates and other guests and what have you, it is very packed. So it's not something where you can easily just space people out and say, hey, let's try to meet any of these social distancing requirements. So
No, I mean, you get jostled and you get from one delegation to the other. It could take you 15, 20 minutes. I remember seeing the CEO of General Motors on the floor of a convention. I think it was the 2004 Republicans. And he was kind of looking, ooh, what is this? There are all these people around. I wasn't being treated like a CEO. And I turned to him. I said, Mr. Smith, I said, hey, you're on the convention floor, man. This is not CEO land anymore. Trump will get all sorts of comments from the press, which he almost always does, for doing this. But I don't think he'll get the positive bounce because he's not going to be non-committed voters, not going to be turning in voters that can't stand Trump or are on the fence, probably not going to be watching. Viewership is down. And the conventions no longer serve that unique communications medium, and they have lost the audience of movable voters at a time when there were fewer movable voters than there used to be.
Michael Barone, our guest here on Jimmy at the Crossroads, senior political analyst at the Washington Examiner on this Washington Examiner Wednesday edition of the program. Final topic for you before we let you go, Michael, since you just led into some of the political dynamics. How do you think 2020 is shaping up from two particular standpoints? One, Trump versus Biden and the president's reelection bid, which looks very tough. And then also the United States Senate and House of Representatives. What are your sort of big picture assessments at this point as we go into the month of July and the second half of the year?
Well, I think a lot of the Democrats are licking their chops right now. They, we've been existing for the last 25 years or so, since the middle 1990s, in a situation where the two parties' constituencies are pretty closely balanced. It has also meant that activists, party leaders, party elected officials can have reasonably hope that they're going to get a trifecta at the federal government, that they're going to get the presidency, the Senate, the House. All the things are going to line up. Of course, it doesn't always work out that way. We have divided government about two-thirds of the time, but we have had periods where the parties have gotten all three things, and the Democrats think that they might do that. I mean, President Trump has emerged from the coronavirus period with a diminished job rating. I think the idea that he was, when we're facing a virus, a pandemic, when we're facing violation, he's going to go after whether or not the death of one of Joe Scarborough's congressional aides in 19 years ago, and he's going to go tweet about that, as sort of a huge wrong footing of the nomination. And we've got Joe Biden. He's going to be 78 years old when he's inaugurated, if he's elected president next November. That's basically the same. That's older than Ronald Reagan was when he left office after 8 years, the oldest president in history. So I think it's kind of bizarre that we've had two septuagenarians competing and apparently winning the party nomination. The Democrats have a chance to pick up the U.S. Senate. The concatenation of states that have seats up this year tends to give them many more targets than the Republicans have, and you've got some problems there. The House of Representatives, I think Democrats are favored to keep their majority, though I think that's not inevitable. So, they're hopeful. The one thing that I think that to keep in mind, and to compare this with the political standings in January, when it didn't seem nearly as likely that we get a Democratic trifecta, is that things can change. Events can happen. You've got a character, Joe Biden, currently 77 years old, has some cognitive weaknesses that have appeared. I first interviewed him in May 1972, so I've had a long experience interacting with him over a long period of time. And, if I'm missing a step now, he's missing a step now. I think that, that could have negative connotations, or ham-handed attempts by Donald Trump or Republican supporters to attack him could have a negative consequences for them. There's some factors that remain undecided, and we didn't know we were going to have a pandemic in January. Dr. Fauci didn't think we would. probably the world's greatest expert. So who am I to say what's going to happen between now and November?
Yeah, you never know. I remember shortly before the November 2016 election, you weren't so confident that President Trump could pull, then candidate Trump could pull it off, because that was just so unusual what was going on in that cycle. 2020 is so unusual. I mean, this is one of those situations where it's like, can you really make a reasonable prediction at this point, or even it come October? I'm not so sure that's possible.
Well, you know, I used to say a joke that the good news is that the baby boom generation is going to die out. The bad news is I'm going to die about the same time. And that used to get a pretty good laugh. I think with Joe Biden, arguably of the baby boom generation, perhaps a little older, depending on how you date it. Donald Trump, our third president, born in the baby boom year of 1946, running with the different weaknesses that each of them has, that joke isn't very funny anymore. And it's looking a little more bizarre for a combination of two-party candidates. So that's what the 89th and 90th national conventions are going to give us, and we'll see what we get in November.
Well, it was so strange, as I remember 2016, there was all this young blood up on the stage in the Republican primary debates, and then you had all these younger Democrats that were up on the stage in the Democratic primary debates, and Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. And then it happened to be Joe Biden that becomes the nominee, and of course, President Trump's running for re-election, and we know that he won in 2016. It's like basically saying, nope, you got to wait a little longer. Gen X in particular, we might find that the next generation is millennials that get to become president, and he skipped Gen X.
Well, Gen X has Gen X candidates defined as people born after 1962. At least by my definition, got 37% of the vote in the Republican primaries and caucuses in 2016. In the Democratic primaries and caucuses of 2020, they just got 4% of the vote. It was Pete Buttigieg, Tulsi Gabbard, and Andrew Yang were their the Gen X people. So, it's not clear that Gen X is ever going to get there at this point.
Harris and Harris and Booker both fit in there as well. Did you mention them?
Well, you could put Harris and Booker there, but you're still looking at a pretty low number of people.
Sure. Michael Barone, always fascinating. The one-man American political almanac, senior political analyst at the Washington Examiner. Thanks so much for joining us here on Jimmy at the Crossroads for Washington Examiner
Wednesday.
Good
to be with you. Take care. Take care.
Back here now on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. Of course, that interview from my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner, Jimmy at the Crossroads. And, you know, I want to take a moment here to do another bonus bumper. Junior Wells, one of my absolute favorite blues men, especially on the harmonica. You know what? Junior Wells, well, he smells something.
Oh! Hit it! I smell something. Come on! Get back. Hit it. Ain't it funky now? Get it, y'all. Do it like you're gonna do it. Come on, come on. Wait. I smell something. I wonder where it is. I smell some good body. I wonder where it is. Can't be me or something cool. Can't be the blues. I've been to school. Might be boogie woogie. A little disco too. Tell me, God done it, baby. What you want your dad to do?
Ain't it funky now, little Junior Wells? Bringing us our second bonus bumper of the evening here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. News Talk 710 KNUS. Junior Wells, one of the great harmonica players of all time. Good friends, by the way, he was with Buddy Guy. Junior Wells passed away a number of years ago. Buddy Guy is still alive. And actually, Buddy was on guitar in this very tune. It is Independence Day 2020. And let us remember those who have fallen on this day. On this day, let's remember those who have fallen in service of this country to protect us, to ensure that our freedoms, as declared in the Declaration and codified in the Constitution, that those freedoms would be protected. If you're listening today and you served our country in uniform, thank you for your service. Thank you for your sacrifice. The same goes to those who have passed away, who came back to this country to pick up their lives, maybe after World War II, Vietnam, and passed away afterwards. Thank you for your sacrifice. And for those who perished on the battlefield, who paid the ultimate sacrifice while serving our country overseas, eternal thanks to you as well. These are tremendous people, those who have served our country in uniform. And I know I'm grateful. I know countless Americans and everyone in our 710KN U.S. audience is grateful to you for carrying on the legacy of the founding fathers, those who brought forth on this continent, as Lincoln said, a nation conceived in liberty. That's what we acknowledge on this Independence Day. That's what's so important. What's so near and dear and worth highlighting, worth teaching our nation's young people about. Make no mistake, we all have a duty here right now to carry the torch of liberty and continue to advance that which so many have sacrificed before us. Thank you. I'm Jimmy Sangenberger. Two more hours up ahead on this Independence Day 2020 edition of the program. We will talk higher education costs and apprenticeships in the next hour as we continue here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS. Don't go anywhere.